With the opening of Chumash Shemos, as we note, we move from the story of the family to the nation. And Bnei Yisrael are in Mitzrayim. The good days don't last too long. And before we look around, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Ches, Vayakom Melech Chodosh al Mitzrayim. A new king. Rashi, citing the Gemara actually, quotes two opinions. What is the meaning of a new king? I think it's apropos to speak of rain. So the new king, Rabbi Shmuel, the two classic sages of the Talmud. What does new mean? Chad Omar Chadash Mamash. One says it was literally a new king. And one opinion says that it was the same king, but his decrees were, well, nischatshu literally means renewed. How is there room for two explanations or two interpretations? The words melech chodosh seem to be simple enough. Chadash means new. New means new. And one of them insists that it's the same king, but his decrees were new. As Mefarshim point out, generally, whenever there is a new king, presumably it's because something happened to the old king, we hear what happened to the old king. We've had in Parshas Vayishlach a succession of kings of Edom, that were not yet kings of Israel, but kings of Edom. And when a new king takes over, we say goodbye to the old one first, Vayomos, whoever it was, and Vayakom Tachtav, the new king. That's how it goes for those seven or eight kings. Here, there is no Vayomas Paro. We've seen in Pasuk Vayomas Yosef Bechol Echov Bechol Ador, who the transition to a new generation begins with the end of the first generation. But when it comes to this new king, there is no end of the first king. It's just Vayakom Melech Chadash. And that, Mefarshim suggests, is why one of these sages of the Talmud maintains that there was no Vayomos, because it's the same king. He's called new because Nischatshu Gezeirosa. And what do we know about him? What does the Pasuk say about him? Asher lo yota es Yosef. He didn't know Yosef. Rashi again comments, Oso atzmo ki ilu lo yota. He made like he didn't know. Interestingly, whereas for Melech Chadosh, Rashi gives two interpretations, actually new, or the same king, but his decrees were new. When it comes to Asher Lo Yoda, Rashi only gives one interpretation. He made like he didn't know. We might have expected a parallel, as if to say, if he's the same king, but his decrees were renewed, so when it says he didn't know Yosef, which of course he did, it's he made like he didn't know Yosef. But if it really is a new king, so then everything is new. So maybe he actually really just didn't know him. But again, as Mefarshim point out, even if he's a new king, everyone knows Yosef. There's no one who doesn't know Yosef. I mean, he saved the country. Which means whether he's a different person or the same person, there's no such thing as actually not knowing Yosef. And therefore, for all approaches and for all views, Rashi says lo yada means he made like he didn't know, because there was no one who actually didn't know. Interestingly, Unkelus translates the words asher lo yada es Yosef, who didn't know Yosef, delo mekayim gezeiras Yosef. He didn't fulfill Yosef's decrees. Asher lo yada es Yosef means Delo Mekayim Gezeiras Yosef, did not fulfill Yosef's decrees. So this, of course, is very intriguing. We're not aware that Yosef made any decrees. And what is the meaning of Paro not fulfilling Yosef's decrees? What were they? And what did they look like when they were fulfilled? And what does Paro look like when he's not fulfilling them anymore? Well, it happens to be that there was one decree or a set of decrees of Yosef. And they are mentioned, actually, in the end of Parshas Vayigash. I think it's fair to say that by that stage in Vayigash, with so much of the drama, everyone's recovering towards the end of the Parsha, we might not give it the full attention to note the details of what's happening. But the Pasuk does describe how the famine began and people didn't have enough food or whatever it was, Egyptians, that is to say. And progressively, Yosef indentures them and makes them subject more and more to Paro. Their land is subject to Paro, and they become servants to Paro to a degree. Hinenu avadim leParo. I mean, that these are these stages: year one, year two, the whole thing. So it's interesting because Yosef doesn't just provide food for them, but actually works in the service of Paro to make the subjects even more subjected. Although one may have imagined that in ancient Egypt, even in a normal situation, they're about as subjected as they can be. There's no civil rights or and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, Yosef took the added measure of making them actively subject to Paro. Why does Yosef do this? He does this in the service of Paro. He does this in order to promote Paro's and consolidate and develop Paro's power even more. However, something happened. And that is, at a certain stage, whether it's a new king, or whether it's the same king who needs to renew things, he feels that he needs to gain the favor of the people. A new king certainly needs to do that. There are historical discussions as to whether it was even a new tribe that took in and came in and took over. Be that as it may, he wants to gain the people. He wants to gain their favor. He wants to gain their goodwill. But how does he do that? What he does is he turns the people against Yosef. That is to say, what so often happens, can happen, and has happened, is that you have people like Yosef, who are the facilitators, who are working to promote the king under which they under which they are and whom they serve. But when a new king comes along, so the way that he gets back the favor of the people is by turning on the Yosef or the Jew or whoever who made all of that possible for the first king. As if to say, new power comes in. And how does he get the goodwill of the people? He says, that remember that Yosef, he turned you into slaves, but I'm Paro. I'm the people's king. I'm the people's champion. I'm restoring the freedom that Yosef took away from you. And with that, the people now become his best friend. All of this at the expense of Yosef, who did it either in the service of the first king or in his own service. And that's always the danger, if one may say, of people like Yosef being in the middle. Because whatever they do for the first monarch or the first regime will then is liable to be turned against them as a new regime comes in. And that, the Be'er Yosef suggests, is the meaning behind the words D'lo mekayim gezeiras Yosef. He did not fulfill Yosef's decrees. Yosef's decrees were to make the people more enslaved to Paro. Paro releases them from that, even though it was done for his own benefit. And with this, he makes Paro the friend of the people, and Yosef and all of that the enemy of the people. And with that, it becomes possible to ignore now all the kindness that Yosef did for Egypt. And in its time, Yosef saved the country. How is it possible to ignore that? How is it possible to turn on Yosef's people with no moral compunction? But the easy way out is to ascribe an agenda and to show that it was all part of some type of scheme or machination on their part, and therefore there is no gratitude due to them for all the good that he did, because it was really serving some type of further fifth column interest which Paro is saving the people from. And with that, he divests Yosef of any claim to some type of recognition or appreciation on the part of the people, anything can happen to the Jewish people now. And indeed, the Shibud begins. There are a couple of things that we know about the subjugation in Mitzrayim, and some of them are quite curious. They're well-known midrashim. Even children know them. They switch around the work of the men to the women, of the women to the men. What did that look like back in the day? It sounds like they had the women working in the field, and the men were whatever they were doing, sewing or cooking. One doesn't know exactly what it looked like. In our time, I think it just means that they would switch laptops, but the differences between them were more pronounced back in the day. But this then begs the question, what is the goal of Paro? What is he looking to achieve by enslaving the Jewish people, especially as he then frustrates them by really setting them to work in areas that they are not adept, not productive, not efficient? So what's the goal? One of the psukim, which is a little harder to understand, even on a pshat level, and I think most of the psukim in the parsha, on the pshat level, they're straightforward. There's, of course, plenty more to say. But if we take a look at Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yutes, so we've moved forward to the Mare Hasneh, of course, much to say, and we'll go back to fill in the gaps. But here is Hashem talking to Moshe, and he says, you're to request a 3-day break. And then Pasuk Yotes reads, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yotes. Va'ani yodati, says Hashem. I know. Ki lo yiten eschem melech Mitzrayim la'aloch. He won't let you go. Interesting. At this very first juncture, Hashem is already informing Moshe that, in principle, Paro will not let you go. Ki lo yiten eschem melech Mitzrayim la'aloch. He won't let you go. Velo biyad chazaka, and not with a strong hand. And this is a difficult phrase to translate on a straightforward level. What's not on a strong hand? What is that referring to? What is it qualifying? The opening words of the pasuk says, Paro will not let you go. Velo biyad chazaka, and not with a strong hand. It sounds like Paro's refusal will not be with a strong hand. He won't let you go, but it won't be with a strong hand. Is that true? I think Paro's refusal was with a strong hand. Initially, he even made things worse, and certainly every time he refuses, it's most adamantly, it's most emphatically. It sounds like Yad Chazaka. I mean, what else could one ask for, that it would be Yad Chazaka? Which means that these three words, velo biyad chazaka, require treatment. Another interesting question, which leads us to the whole issue of the hardening of Paro's heart, which is a core theme throughout Shmos, Va'era, Bo, and even the beginning of Beshalach. This incredible concept, his heart is hardened, and he must refuse. The Beis Halevi asked an interesting question. When we look at this idea, or can ponder this idea, we picture Paro, and he just says no because he can't say yes, because Hashem has hardened his heart. But the interesting question is, how does Paro look at all of this? What does Paro make of his inability to say yes? What's going through his mind? For us, it's all self-understood. Hashem has hardened his heart, we know he's going to say no, and when he says no, it makes perfect sense to us. But it doesn't make perfect sense to Paro. Does he hear himself say no and have no idea why he's saying no? Or what is Paro thinking throughout all of this? Presumably, Moshe has not shared with him the beginning of Parshas Shemos, where Hashem says, I'm going to harden Paro's heart. It's Paro by himself. So what does he make of it, of his own behavior? And that is why the Beis Halevi has a very thought-provoking thesis, and as we'll see, it's based on numerous sources and quite challenging. We know that practically the Jewish people, that is us, well, on a very low spiritual level, operationally, by the time we left Mitzrayim. It tends to be whenever we talk about the Jewish people on a low spiritual level, we talk about them as the Jewish people. When they're doing well, they're us. When they're not doing well, they're the Jewish people. It's the same people. It's us either way. So we received the Torah and they made the Egel, but it's the same. So we, the people, were on this low level. It's a famous statement in the name of the Arizal. The Jewish people are on the 49th level of Tumah. That's as low as it goes, if there's ever hope of return. And even in the words of the Medrash, there's a famous presentation of the Jewish people at the Yam Suf. When the sea splits open and the Jewish people go through, it's held open for them, but it's about to close on in the Egyptians, and the Sultan comes to accuse. Famous words of the Medrash. Why should it be open for them and close in on them? What's the difference between them? In the words of the Medrash, Halala of the Avodah Zarah, Halala of the Avodah Zarah. These are idol worshippers. These are idol worshippers. Now you can yet distinguish and cite distinctions between them, but that doesn't sound like the Jewish people are in such a good state. Indeed, this was part of their experiences in Mitzrayim, as if to say, alongside the physical subjugation, there was a spiritual fall. And both of these came from Mitzrayim. In fact, the Yalkut Shimoni, comments on the first two of the signs that Moshe was given as he's meant to present to the Jewish people. What are the signs? As we know, in Perek Dalet. Firstly, Hashem says, take your stick, throw it to the ground, and what happened? It turned into a snake. And then when he picked it up, it turned back into the staff again. That's sign number one. Sign number two, he takes his hand, he puts it into his tunic, and then he takes it out. It's tsaras, it's mitzora kashelik, leprous, whatever tsaras is, and then he takes it out again, it comes back. What is the significance of these two signs? They're both miracles, but there are many miracles, as we are hearing. The Yalkut explains that these two signs represent two planes of damage, when you think about it. Says Yalkut, Man nachash mamis. A snake bite kills physically. So too, the damage that was sustained for the Jewish people by the Egyptians was physical damage. The backbreaking labor with all that went with that. But then the Yalkut says that, but there was another aspect to what happened. Tumah. Saras is Tomei. Because Mitzrayim were also Mitame. And therefore these two signs, the snake and the leprous hand, represent the two planes of damage sustained by the Jewish people on the part of the Egyptians, physical and spiritual. And indeed, according to some, this is what we refer to later on in Chumash Devarim, the section of Aramia Vedavi, which we say on Seder night, and then it's very, very abridged. We go back and expand. So we say, Vayoreyu osanu hamitzrim vayanunu. Vayoreyu osanu hamitzrim vayanunu. And the simple translation is, they were bad to us and they afflicted us. But Vayoreyu osanu doesn't sound like they were bad to us. The way to say they were evil to us would be Vayoreyu lanu, as indeed it says in Chukas, Parshas Chukas, Vayoreyu lanu hamitzrim. So if them being evil to us is Vayareyu lanu, what is Vayareyu osanu? And that's why certain Mefarshim say Vayareyu osanu doesn't mean they were evil to us, but they made us bad, meaning they influenced us and affected us so that we were not at our best spiritually. They made us into bad people, Vayareyu osanu, and they afflicted us. And for this reason, the Eser Makos, which of course will dominate next week's Parsha and a lot of Parsha's Bo, they're quite a production. There's a lot of instilling of awareness of Hashem as creator of the world, way beyond what you'd need to let the Jewish people go. If it's just about affecting the Exodus, you only need one plague and it doesn't let up until the Jewish people are safely out. But it doesn't work that way. There's 10 plagues, and each plague is a message and a demonstration. And this demonstration is as much for the Jewish people as it is for Paro. Because Paro had caused them to be distanced from Hashem, the leprous hand, Vayoreyu Osanu, and therefore Paro has to pick up the bill for their re-education and for their rehabilitation spiritually, which comes through the Makos. So we can identify quite clearly, as we've seen, two planes of damage, physical and spiritual. The point of the Beis HaLevi is that Paro's primary goal was the spiritual damage. Paro's primary aim was to bring the Jewish people down spiritually. Perhaps, as Paro, he's not comfortable with a spiritually superior people, which might then be awkward for him or cast aspersions on the way that the Paro does things, and therefore the presence, the moral presence and the spiritual presence of the Jewish people, that's what irked him more than anything else. Vayakutsu mipnei b'nei Yisrael. So much so, the Beis HaLevi understands that it is to that end, it is with the goal in mind of bringing the Jewish people down spiritually, that Paro subjugates them. It's not in order for them to enlist them as a workforce, because he makes them work in an ineffective way. He's looking to break their spirit. He gives the men's work to the women, the women's work for the men. He's not looking for productivity, but he's looking for an emotional and moral decline. And indeed, the Yalkut says elsewhere, cited by the Beis HaLevi, that the Mitzvim said to the Jewish people, you know, if you stop doing Mila on your children, so then we'll stop the subjugation. Which clearly implies that the subjugation itself was a means to bring about a spiritual decline. If you'll take care of the spiritual decline yourself, then the physical subjugation won't be necessary. And indeed, with this in mind, the Beis HaLevi brings us to a very interesting comment in Bereishis Rabbah. Sometimes you have psukim later in Tanakh, certainly in Sfarim like, you know, Tehillim and Mishlei and Koheles, which are stated quite generally, which are then adduced to explain certain situations in the Chumash. There is a pasuk in Koheles which describes man, one of the psukim which are quite dim with regards to life, physical life. Ki kol yamav machovim v'kas inyano. Kol yamav machovim, all his days are ke'ev, pain, v'kas inyano. And his matter is ka'as. What does ka'as mean? Interestingly, I think this is correct, although one can certainly check. I'm not sure that the term ka'as is used in Tanakh in the way that we use it, or for that matter, even the way Chazal used it. In other words, from the words of Chazal, whenever you see the word kaas, it means anger. But when the Chumash or the Tanakh wants to talk about someone getting angry, it doesn't say kaas, I don't think. It says katsaf, like paro katsaf alavadav, or vayiktsof hamelech ma'od. It doesn't say paro kaas. So it's a very interesting thing. Sometimes you find this, that already post-Tanakh, Chazal are using certain words in a somewhat different way than the Tanakh uses it. And it's deliberate. It's for a reason. It's to preserve a certain distinction for the way these words are used in Tanakh. Kaas in Tanakh, I believe, is not so much anger in terms of a temper, but rather frustration. Kaas, frustration at the futility of something. That I think is a point that's worth pursuing when we see all usages of the word kas in Tanakh. But certainly Chazal, already from Chazal, kas means anger. And Chazal, the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, takes this pasuk in Koheles, which has two parts to it. All his days are pain, the matter is anger. And what are these two phrases? Says the Medrash, it refers to Mitzrayim, what they did to the Jewish people. Phrase number one, Kol Yamav Machovim, there was pain all day. That's the Jewish people, that's the subjugation, the physical subjugation, there was pain all day. But Vakas in Yano, what's the second? Sheikh Isu Lakodesh Baruch Hu B'ma'aseihem. They angered Lakodesh Baruch Hu with their actions. Namely, the Jewish people began to anger Hashem with the way that they were acting. And these are the two planes again. But what's interesting is, what's telling in this Medrash is that as much as it's identified these two planes, it says one of them happened, but what was the inyan? What is the meaning of the word inyan? Lahabdul, as we would use the word inyan. What maha inyan? What's the point? What's the goal? Here the Medrash is saying that the Jews' life in Egypt was full of pain. True. But what was the goal? The goal was kaas, to get the Jewish people to this lower spiritual state where they'd be angering Hashem. So you have the description, but you have the goal. The inyan was kaas. And in fact, he goes further, because back to the two signs, right? The staff becomes a snake, the hand becomes leprous. Why does the staff become a snake? That's the physical, a snake kills, physically. But it's interesting that of all the ways to describe the physical damage done from the Egyptians to the Jewish people, a snake bite is chosen. I don't know meaningfully how many other options there were, presumably limitless or either none, because it is a staff. And it could turn into a lion, but maybe just intuitively, conservation of matter, a lion will become a snake. But it's not for nothing. The Chazal have a certain depiction about a snake. Namely, unlike other animals, it gets very little from the kill. It injects its venom, kills its victim, and then moves on. It's a famous Gemara in Maseches Tainis, which compares Lashon Hara to a snake. Im yishokha nachash belo lachash, umay yitron lebal halashon. Just like a snake bites, so what about Lashon Hara? And what's the meaning of this? That people come to the animals will come to the snake and they'll say, what do you get out of your kills? Animals of prey, at least they get to devour their prey. So there's something in it for them. There's a payoff. But for you, you kill and you move on. To which the snake will reply, what are you looking at me for? Go to a Baal Lashon Hara. What does he get out of it? He kills and he moves on. So whatever geschmack is in there for the Baal Lashon Hara, so that's how a snake works. But what's interesting is, the snake is identified by Chazal as an animal that can kill, can inflict damage and worse, but with no direct benefit from that. And that's Mitzrayim. That's why the physical damage is portrayed by a snake, because the physical damage was not the goal. There was no direct benefit from them. They had everyone doing everyone else's work, but it was for some other reason. As we said, Vakas Inyano. Paro does not make his essential goal public. If his central goal is to destroy the Jewish people spiritually, that is not something that Paro wishes to publicize. He much more portrays, as we see from the verses, that the Jewish people are our enemies, they're the enemies of Egypt, they'll ally themselves with our enemies, they'll take over, all the threats that we would yet hear in many other occasions. But what really bothers Paro about the Jewish people, that he doesn't say. And this is what is at the heart of the hardening of Paro's heart. Is the Beis Halevi, like others that we've mentioned on other occasions, he understands that there is a certain process, even within Paro, which makes him feel that he should be stubborn. But what is it? It's not just that he can't explain why he's saying no. He has good reason to say no in his mind. Why? Because what does Moshe come to Paro for? And what does he request? He requests, we want 3 days. Why do we want 3 days? You'll get your workforce back, because that's obviously important for you. We just want 3 days. V'nizbecha l'Hashem Elokeinu. We want to recharge spiritually. We wish to have a religious festival. And Moshe presents this to Paro as something that Paro should have no reason to object to. After all, says Moshe to Paro, you want your workforce, so you'll get it. All the Jewish people want is to recharge spiritually. And Paro is listening to this and saying, something's missing here. Something's wrong. If he represents not only an all-powerful, but an all-knowing God, how could he not know that the one thing that I would most object to is a spiritual recharge? If the whole subjugation has been with the goal of the spiritual decline of the Jewish people, how would he present their spiritual rehabilitation as something that I should only be too happy to accept? And therefore, Paro continues. He feels, if this is how it's being presented, his God doesn't know as much as he seems, or pretends to know, or protests to know. And therefore, there's got to be another weakness. I'll just need to keep going, and I will prevail. In other words, to put it in one sentence, it's a manipulation of sorts of Paro. Hashem knows that Paro's primary objective is their spiritual decline. Vakas inyano. But he makes himself as if he doesn't know. He makes himself as if he believes Paro's words at face value, that he just wants to subjugate them to keep them from not being a physical threat. He doesn't care about their spiritual state. But that leads Paro to feel that Hashem doesn't understand him. He doesn't really know what's going on. And if he doesn't really know what's going on, so then he's not all-knowing and perhaps also not all-powerful. And Paro thus continues to refuse. But when he refuses, he can't exactly say why. That's why the Pasuk says, I'm telling you now, he's not going to let you go. The way that you'll present your request will lead him to say no. But v'lo biyad hazaka. Those three words that were difficult for us. V'lo biyad hazaka. But not, he will not object strongly. He will not object openly. And our question was, he does object openly. He does object strongly. But the point is, he won't object and show his hand with the real source of his objection, that he wants to subjugate them spiritually. That he'll keep to himself. That's where the hardening of his heart comes from, and that's something that he will not proclaim openly. That's velo biyad hazaka. So it's a very, very interesting, it's a lengthy piece from the Beis Halevi. Even what we have said, which covers many of the points, is merely a synopsis. But certainly the questions that it raises, especially the issue of how to understand the phenomenon of the spiritual decline of the Jewish people accompanying their physical subjugation. Were both of them programmed? Was one the ikkar? Was one just incidental? Or was it really the goal all along? Very thought-provoking comments from Beis Halevi. And again, everything that is discussed with regards to Paro is often a harbinger for, or portent for later subjugations, and each one takes their own specific sinister form throughout the history of Jewish persecution. I'd like to just spend our final section by looking at a few words in a pasuk in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Beis. And as we'll see, this discussion is one which begins in our parsha, but by no means ends there. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Katbeis. So Hashem tells Moshe to come to Paro. Va'amarta el Paro, and so you shall say, Ko amar Hashem, b'ni b'chari Yisrael. So says Hashem, my son, my firstborn, Yisrael. What does it mean that Yisrael are Hashem's sons? Like we say, Banim Hashem L'Hashem Elokeichem, that special relationship. What does it mean that we are his Bechor, his firstborn? Does that mean he has other sons, but we're the firstborn? In what way are we the firstborn? We're certainly not the firstborn historically. There's a lot of discussion about the meaning of B'nai B'chori Yisrael, and our status as B'chor is actually key within the redemption from Mitzrayim, because it's very much wired into Makas B'choros, and we refer to this the whole time. We say, Kol B'choreim Haragta U'V'chorcha Ga'alta. Every morning we say that. Mimitzrayim Ga'altanu, Beis Mitzrayim, Kol B'choreim Haragta U'V'chorcha Ga'alta. We refer to the Jewish people as Hashem's B'chor, just like he did within the context of Makas B'choros. Because as we know, the whole issue of B'chorah in Torah is very, very closely associated with Makas B'choros. Either way, the words that I want to focus on, actually, though, are not B'nai B'chori Yisrael, but Ko Amar Hashem. What is there to say about Ko Amar Hashem? It has to be the most classic way to open any message from Hashem. It's used by Nevi'im all over the place. But that is exactly the point. Because the Sifrei informs us in the beginning of Parshas Matos. And what happens in Matos? Moshe introduces a message from Hashem with the words, Zeh HaDavar Asher Tziva Hashem. This is the matter, this is the word that Hashem has commanded. And the Sifrei says, you know, other Nevi'im introduce their nevuah with Ko Amar Hashem. Ko Amar Hashem, Zachartu L'Chesed N'Rayach, Ko Amar Hashem, Matzachem B'Midbar, and so on and so forth. And so does Moshe, also uses Ko Amar Hashem, sometimes, like here, or Ko Amar Hashem Kachatzos Halayla, when he's predicting Makas B'choros. But Moshe also has a unique introductory phrase, signature phrase, for his nevuah, and that is Zeh HaDavar. No one else introduces nevuah with Zeh HaDavar. Only Moshe. The question is, firstly, what's the difference between Zeh HaDavar and Ko Amar Hashem? They sound effectively the same. Ko Amar Hashem, so says Hashem. Zeh HaDavar, this is the word. It's the same, sounds like. But clearly not. But what is the difference? And here there is a major discussion amongst the Mefarshim. What is the connotation of Ko Amar Hashem? What level of nevuah does it represent? And then by contrast, Zeh HaDavar. The Mizrahi, Rabbi Yo Mizrahi, in Parshas Matos, explains that with other Nevi'im, when they present a nevuah, they receive a nevuah message. And the goal of the Navi is to formulate that message into words. They're chosen as a Navi because they have the ability to do that. But it's the Navi that formulates the Nevuah message that he's received into words. That is why Gemara says no two Nevi'im would ever prophesy in exactly the same way. Ein shnei Nevi'im misnabim b'signon echad. That so says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Petes. That is to say, even were they to receive the same Nevuah, they wouldn't say it in the same way, because each Navi says it in the Sur. But of course, they're chosen because they're faithful, and they will faithfully formulate it. Indeed, that actually explains the Nusach of the Bracha that we make before we read from the Nevi'im. We say, before the Haftarah, Asher Bachar B'Nevi'im Tovim, V'Ratzah B'Devrihem Maneh Marim Be'emes. Hashem chooses good Nevi'im, and he likes their words, which were said in truth. Seemingly, it's a very strange thing to say. Of course he likes their words. Where do they come from? From him. So Hashem says, say the following. And the Navi says what Hashem told him to say. And then Hashem says, I like it. Of course you do. You're the one who said it in the first place. He's just transmitting it. But if we understand that what Hashem sends the Navi is a message, but it's the Navi who puts it into words to the best of his ability, so then that's really in praise of the Nevi'im. Hashem chooses Nevi'im Tovim with perfect midos and character traits and so on and so forth. V'ratzah b'divrihem, and then v'ratzah b'emes. And Hashem, he likes their words, which are said in truth, meaning absolutely faithful and integral to the message itself. That is the situation, as far as the Mizrahi is concerned, with Nevuah generally. It's a Chiddush, although I'm not sure what prior knowledge we have about Nevuah to know what's a Chiddush, but the Navi gets the message, formulates into words. This is also the opinion of the Abarbanel in the beginning, his introduction to Sefer Yirmiyah. Zehadavar, in contrast, which is unique to Moshe, so Moshe gets it word for word from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He doesn't need to formulate it. He doesn't need to unravel it. He doesn't need to interpret it. Word for word, exactly the word that Hashem gives, those are the words that he says. That's the difference between Komar Hashem generally, for Nebuah, and Zehadavar. Other Mephoshim, we should know, take strong exception to this approach. As far as they're concerned, every Navi receives the words from Hashem. Ko'amar Hashem means exactly like this, Hashem said. Word for word. Okay. We're not going to get it. We don't have to arbiter or paskin between these different mefarshim. But if Ko'amar Hashem is already the words, so what's Ze'adavar? You've got the words. Even Ko'amar Hashem is the words themselves. What's Ze'adavar? Says the Netziv in his commentary to the Sifrei, Parshas Matos, and the Malbim. In the introduction to Yirmiyah, taking issue with the Abarbanel there. It's basically war on all fronts. Zeh davar, the word zeh always has the connotation of when you're in the presence of something. No Navi can ever transmit the Nevuah when he's in the presence of Nevuah. Because every Navi is always in some type of dream or trance or sleep state to receive the Nevuah. There's only one, and therefore necessarily, when he tells you what Hashem said, Hashem has finished saying it to him, and then he wakes up and then transmits it. He can transmit it word for word, but he's no longer in the presence of Hashem's word. Only Moshe can receive and transmit Nevuah simultaneously, because he can receive Nevuah when he's awake, and in real time, as we would say, transmit it. So when he tells you what Hashem says, he's telling you as Hashem is saying it to him. He's in the presence of Hashem's word. That's Zeh. The word Zeh always has a connotation of being in the presence of something. Ba'avur Zeh, lo amarti, ela b'sheh shah, sheish matzah, umarim lefanecha, etc. So these are the classic discussions of the difference between Ko'amar Hashem and Zeh HaDavar. But the question that we now proceed to ask is, if Moshe is unique, lo kam b'Yisrael navi o kam Moshe, and that's why he has his unique introduction to Nevuah, reflecting his unique madriga of Nevuah, Zeh HaDavar, as opposed to others who are Ko'amar Hashem. But we find that Moshe also uses Ko'amar Hashem, sometimes, in our Pasuk, and Ko'amar Hashem Kachatzos HaLaila, etc. The simple question, therefore, is, if Moshe is unique, and that's why he says Zeh HaDavar, as opposed to Ko'amar Hashem. So why does he ever say Ko'amar Hashem? Is he the same and unique at the same time? Unique means unique. And here too, there are two classic explanations of this matter. The Mizrahi himself says, and there's basis for his position in the Medrash, Shmos Rabbah, that Moshe was unique, but he didn't begin unique. Very interesting to consider, and obviously there's a very delicate discussions. Moshe became unique among the Avla Nevi'im, a madrega that was never reached by anyone else, but not immediately. Mizrahi understands that he began like other Nevi'im, and then at a certain point he graduated to his unique level. And that's why you find that the Ko'amar Hashems are in the beginning, in Mitzrayim, because he's beginning. And his initial stages of Nevuah were the normal level, Ko'amar Hashem. At a certain point, he comes into his own. We assume that point is around Matan Torah time.
Not the snap.
Still Ko'amar Hashem. Well, if we're looking for a marker, and if we're looking for the first Zeh HaDavar, it's actually just after Kriyas Yamsuf, when the man falls in Perek Tetzayin, Pasuk Tetzayin, and Moshe tells him how to collect the man. Zeh HaDavar Asher Tziva Hashem Diktu Mimenu. So that's the first Zeh HaDavar. From that point, says the Mizrahi, there's no looking back. You have before and after. Before, he's like other Nevi'im, afterwards, he comes into his own. Before you have Kol Hashem, after you have Zeh HaDavar. Now, as we can appreciate, you can't say something like that without having at least one person come after you and check every single time that Moshe says a nevuah after that point and see whether there are any Ko'amar Hashems. And indeed, someone did. And he found one. And that is in Parshas Kisisa. The Chet HaEgel. Where they made the Chet HaEgel. And let's take a look at the Pasuk actually. Perek Lamed Beis. Pasuk Kaf Zayin. So the Jewish people have made the eagle. Moshe comes down, and he has his famous call. Mi Lashem Elai, Bnei Levi come to him. Vayomer Lahem, and he says to them, Ko Amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. So says Hashem. And you need to deal with all of those who were directly involved in the Egel. So as we've already seen from Parshas Beshalach, from the time the man fell, Moshe's already in Zeh HaDavar. The Mizrahi said from the time he's in Zeh HaDavar, he never goes back. But this is after that point, and he's going back. Needs to be explained. This is the question of the Tzedel HaDerech. Say the Laderach, Rabbi Yisachar Ber Eilenberg, one of the early Acharonim, classic Perush on Rashi. So, how will we explain? So, I hope what I'm about to say is not too simple. It's either correct or complete amaratzos, but I think it might be correct. And that is, I think the explanation of Mizrahi's position may actually come from Rashi himself, which of course is good. Because they're all commenting on Rashi. If you look in Rashi's comment on that pasuk, Perek Lamed Beis, pasuk Kaf Zayin. Once again, the pasuk says, "Vayom Alem Koamar Hashem Elokei Yisrael." So says Hashem, "Simish Chabal Yirecho." Everyone should gird their sword. If we reshuv mishal Hashem Machane, v'higu esizachit. You need to deal with the people that were involved, right? Some of them need to archive misa, need to be executed. Says Rashi. Commenting on Ko Amar Hashem. V'heichan Omar. Where did he say? Moshe says, so said Hashem. And Rashi asks, where? And Rashi answers, Zoveach lo Elohim Yocharam. Which is a quotation from Parshas Mishpatim. Whoever offers to false idols needs to be destroyed. That's the Mechilta. So to summarize Rashi's comment on this pasuk, Moshe says, Ko Amar Hashem, and Rashi says, where? Moshe is saying, you need to execute these people that were involved in the Egel. So says Hashem, Rashi, where did he say that? And you know, the answer is Parshas Mishpat, the pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. Rashi cites the Mechilta. When you think about it, Rashi's actual question is baffling. As if to say, Ko Amar Hashem is the way a Navi introduces Nevuah. When he introduces a Nevuah, so it's meaningless to ask, he says, so said Hashem. And someone will come along and say, well, where did he say that? Presumably the answer is just now. Or very recently, because it's being relayed by the Navi. If we can envisage, Yirmiyahu Navi comes in, Ko Amar Hashem, Zachartu L'Chesed Nerayah, so says Hashem, Zachartu L'Chesed Nerayah. And one of the audience says, where? I'm not aware of him saying that. Of course you're not. You're not the Navi. Yirmiyah is. And he's telling you that Hashem said it. And presumably, just now. It's fresh. That's how Ko'am Hashem works. Ko'am Hashem, Atzachem B'midbar. Where did he say that? Here. And when Moshe says, Ko'am Hashem, Simu Chabar, Rashi says, where was that? Why not say the same thing? Right now. Maybe Moshe just received it just now, just like Yirmiyahu did. I think the reason why Rashi asked the question where is because it can't be the way that it normally is with Kohen Mar Hashem, for the reason that Moshe is no longer prophesying with Kohen Mar Hashem, as per the Mizrahi, because he's already moved into the unique level of Zeh HaDavar, which means if he's presenting Nevuah from Hashem, it should have been Zeh HaDavar. So if he says Kohen Mar Hashem, it's not presenting a Nevuah. You know what it means? It literally means Hashem has said this somewhere, which entitles us to ask where. And hopefully, we'll find the answer, which we do. It's in Parshas Mishpatim, that pasuk, Zoveach L'Elohim Yacharam. So in other words, I think that Rashi's treatment of this Kohen Mar Hashem shows that it's unusual. It shows that it's not a Nevuah, which I think then answers the question of the Seder L'Aderech. It corroborates the Mizrahi's position. It can't be Nevuah, because Nevuah by this stage would have been Zeh HaDavar. A somewhat different understanding of the divvying up of Kohen Mar Hashem and Zeh HaDavar with Moshe, and with this we'll conclude, comes from the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh. As we know, whenever the Mizrahi speaks on Rashi, Gur Aryeh not far behind. And again, our question is, if Moshe is unique, and he has his unique introduction of Zeh HaDavar, as opposed to other Nevi'im who say Kohen Mar Hashem, so why do we find Kohen Mar Hashem with Moshe also? It should always be Zeh HaDavar. And the Maharal gives a very elegant explanation to this matter. Namely, what is Nevuah? Or more helpfully, what type of things does Nevuah talk about? What is the content of Nevuah generally? Well, look through the Navi and you'll see. Nevuah is generally a message from Hashem to the people, how they should act, exhorting them to do tshuva, to better their ways, telling them about things that will happen in the future. I think it's fair to say that covers almost all of Nevuah. Of course, each setting in its own uniqueness, but that's Nevuah. And Moshe also talks about those things. Sometimes. He also tells the Jewish people how they should act. He also talks about things that will happen in the future. He predicts the Makos. That's Nevuah. But then Moshe has an element to his Nevuah. You know, the jewel in the crown of Moshe's Nevuah is something that only he transmits. Namely, Tarek Mitzvahs. He is the transmitter of the Torah. In addition to things that other Nevi'im talk about, there are certain things that only Moshe talks about. Tarek Mitzvahs. And the Mizrahi, therefore, pardon me, the Gur Aryeh explains that the question as to whether Moshe uses the normal introduction of Nevuah or his special Zeh HaDavar introduction depends on what he's talking about. If he's talking about things that other Nevi'im normally talk about, he'll introduce Nevuah the way it's normally introduced. Kohen Mar Hashem. If Yirmiyahu says, Kohen Mar Hashem, you're going to be in Babel for 70 years, and Moshe says, Kohen Mar Hashem, tomorrow night there's going to be Makkos Bechoros, it's the same. It's the same concept and the same type of Nevuah, and therefore has the same introduction. When does he say Zeh HaDavar with the unique Madrega of Moshe surrounds the receiving and the transmitting of mitzvahs? That's the explanation of the Mizrahi. And with this in mind, pardon me, of the Gurari, and with this in mind, he actually then gives his own explanation as to why Moshe used the words Kohen Mar Hashem at the time of the Egel. Because Moshe was not transmitting a new mitzvah. As Rashi told us, it's an application in that situation of an existing mitzvah. The mitzvah's already been given in Parshas Mishpatim. Whoever serves Avodah Zarah is deserving of the death penalty. Zoveach L'Elohim Yacharam. So the mitzvah's already been transmitted. Now, it's being applied, but that's not transmitting a mitzvah. And therefore, Moshe doesn't need to use his unique type of Nevuah of Zeh HaDavar. Rather, he can use the Kohen Mar Hashem. So says the Gur Aryeh. I was left with a question, and in fact, this question I had a good 15 or so years ago, and at the time I called Rav Yehoshua Hartman, who you may know as basically the one who's really brought the writings of the Maharal into their current format through Machon Yerushalayim. Namely, if Zeh HaDavar is for transmitting a mitzvah of Taryag, one of the 613, and everything else is Karma Hashem, so why is Moshe's instructions regarding collecting the man in Parshas Beshalach introduced with Zeh Adavar? Collecting the man is not one of the 613 mitzvahs. It's a mitzvah, l'sha'a. It's a mitzvah for that time. For 40 years it existed. Initially it was meant to be even for less, a few months, till they got to Eretz Yisrael. It's not one of the 613 mitzvahs. To qualify for one of the 613 mitzvahs, it needs to be a mitzvah l'doros, a mitzvah for all time, perhaps with interruptions, but ultimately will apply. But the mitzvah of collecting man does not apply for all time. So if it's a mitzvah l'sha'a, not one of the 613, why then would it be introduced with the special introduction for Tired Mitzvahs of Zeh HaDavar? Our apartment said he did not have an answer. Maybe I should actually check in with him. It's been a while. But in the meanwhile, certainly food for thought. And the entire discussion really is important for us to get an appreciation. Firstly, to try and ponder through the Mefarshim what Nevuah is, the differences between other Nevi'im and Moshe, and differences between different Nevuahs of Moshe himself, as explained by the Gedolei HaMefarshim, Mizrahi, and the Gur Aryeh. Leave it over here for this evening.